Welcome to Bankless Africa, a podcast by Africans on building and innovating Web3 into a new frontier for the people of Africa. I'm your host, Miss Purple, and each episode, I get together with some wonderful people across the continent and the diaspora to talk, ideate, and dream about the bright future of our people. Stay tuned for another exciting episode.
Hello and welcome to another fantastic episode of Bankless Africa, and today I'm very, very excited because we're going to be speaking to two people that we've been trying to get a chat with them for a while, but you know, life happens and stands in the way, but we are finally here and I think the timing is absolutely perfect. I have with me today, I have Obina and Zhao from Wobbler Labs. How are you both doing today?
I'm doing well, thanks. Excited to be on.
I'm very excited to have you both on. And just for clarification, Obina and Zhao are from Wobbler Labs. And for those that maybe do not know, Goldfinch is a Wobbler Labs product. So we'll be talking more about both Wobbler Labs and more in depth about Goldfinch and a few other things that they may want to shed some light on. But as is tradition here at Bankless Africa, I'm going to ask the both of you to share a bit about your stories. Tell us how you found yourself where you are today in this particular role, specifically working for Wobbler Labs.
Yeah, I can go first. Obina here, by the way. I grew up in Nigeria and came to the US for college and ultimately started my career in investment banking. And kind of after a couple of years in investment banking, went back to Nigeria and ran a fintech company. And I think my experience there really sort of shaped the way I think about what I'm doing now and just sort of led me down this path. So in Nigeria, I ran a fintech lender, and ultimately that company wasn't as successful as we had hoped, primarily because we just didn't have the access to debt capital to scale our operations. And sort of, you know, that was one frustrating, but also sort of led me down this path of like trying to figure out why, you know, we had what I thought was a pretty compelling product, but just didn't have a way to raise debt. But in other parts of the world, folks were raising debt at close to 0% interest rates. And so I think the sort of that opened my eyes to just how siloed the sort of debt, global debt market is. And basically, depending on where you are in the world, you have better access to capital. And so I became really interested in trying to figure out ways to create or contribute to creating a more sort of global debt market where, you know, as long as deals are good and as long as the fundamentals make sense, they can attract capital wherever they are. And so after that experience, I spent some time running a credit fund that effectively raised capital in the US and deployed it as debt into fintech companies in primarily West and East Africa. And then sort of became pretty interested in DeFi as a source of capital for these sorts of activities. I found out about sort of Goldfinch and the Wobbler Labs team through an introduction, and I joined 2 years ago on the credit team to help just basically facilitate and contribute to this sort of solution of this problem that I have been sort of fascinated with and been working on for the last, I would say, 5 years or so.
That is quite a story. And I mean, it sounds like a dream to be able to go back home and start something. But I can imagine there's also a sense of a bit of heartbreak, you know, to try something and then perhaps it doesn't work. But then there's also a silver lining to say that you hopefully then found, you know, a place for yourself to be able to make the difference that you were looking to make, but perhaps not in the way that you had intended, but in this case, as part of the team at Wobbler Labs, because I believe, you know, sometimes it's okay to start off in a different area from how you had initially planned. It's good to hear that, you know, you did find your place eventually. How about you, Zhao?
Thank you. I am a dual citizen of Mali in West Africa and France. I studied undergrad in France, and I always knew that I wanted to work on the continent or do something that was related to, you know, the development of the continent. So right after undergrad, I went to work for a monetary institution in West Africa that basically defines the monetary policy of 8 countries in West Africa, Francophone countries. And I got to work on a very exciting project, which was my first kind of like big professional project, which is the development of the ECHO. The ECHO is this, you know, project at the ECOWAS level of a single currency for 18 countries, including the countries that already share the CFA franc in West Africa, and including Ghana and Nigeria, etc. That project is very old, actually. It was born after the Second World War, but it still hasn't seen the light of day. So I was working on that very exciting project, but I was realizing how slow moving it was, how political it was, and how basically uncertain the project was. And so I thought, okay, I'd like to get closer to the field, see things are moving a bit faster. I had heard a lot about the World Bank, of course, you know, being African, but I had a bit of a negative perspective because of the structural adjustments that happened in the 90s. So I was really not excited about joining one of these large kind of like development institutions at first. But while I was working at the monetary institution, we had received a group of like technical advisors from the World Bank, and they were just brilliant people. So that made me kind of like think twice and be like, okay, maybe this is not, you know, from a political perspective, the most kind of like aligned place, but I think there is a lot to learn. So I decided after that experience to go join the World Bank. So that's when I moved to the US and joined an Africa-related investment team. I was mostly investing in West Africa, but also a little bit in Kenya and South Africa, and focused on private sector development projects. So across sectors, energy, agribusiness, infrastructure like road, railroad, etc. It was a fascinating experience. I really loved it. But again, I thought, okay, like the credit gap is so large. And what we are able to provide first is very slow, it's conditional, and it's very small compared to what we actually need to provide. So I started to think again, okay, like how can I have a bigger impact? What can I do? I decided to go to grad school, took a bit of a break, and during grad school discovered basically the world of tech. I was on the West Coast, and so I thought the West Coast of the United States, and thought, wow, like there's so much that's possible with tech. At that time as well, mobile money is starting to kind of like spread out on the continent. And it becomes very clear that leapfrogging certain infrastructure development is possible for Africa. So I started to kind of like build a thesis for myself that I wanted to do something that was still, you know, basically focused on the development of the continent, but using technology to kind of like, again, accelerate impact. So after I finished grad school, I decided to join the tech practice at McKinsey. And I was doing basically go-to-market and growth, advising tech companies in the US. I also got to work with a couple African companies in media and telco, and advising them on their growth strategy. So that was also fascinating. Really, really a lot of learnings. But again, I wanted to like go back to the field. So at McKinsey, it was more of an advisory role, lots of learning, great exposure to, you know, fascinating leaders, but I wanted to again go back on the field. So at that time, I started to ask myself, like, which technologies in my, like, which technologies had the best potential to impact the continent. And in 2021, on a trip to Mali, I kind of like realized that people were really adopting crypto for use cases that in my mind were very new. So I knew people who were actually like investing and with very small amounts started to become, you know, traders and brokers, which I thought was fascinating. There were also people in other parts of the world that were really starting to kind of like take this technology seriously and develop applications that I thought were fascinating. So I went onto a decentralized finance rabbit hole, a DeFi rabbit hole, and just like my mind was blown. I realized that a lot of the challenges that I had found on the monetary kind of like side of things could be alleviated with crypto. A lot of the things I had, you know, been basically kind of like disappointed with on the policy side, on the governance side, could also to a certain extent be kind of like solved with crypto, because it is a system that can be trustless, or at least can rely less on kind of like humans trusting each other and more on like systems kind of like having a record of truth. So that was fascinating to me, and specifically in decentralized finance, kind of like the opportunity to build completely new infrastructure outside of the existing financial system that had failed the continent and so many other parts of the world, sounded extremely exciting. So I decided that I wanted to join specifically that space, and I started to look for companies that had both a very solid blockchain use case and a focus on emerging markets. And so that's how I found Goldfinch, and I joined the BizOps team. So what I do as part of the BizOps team is mostly launching products from the operational and business side of things. And I absolutely love it.
I think both your stories are really fascinating, because none of them are super cut and dry. You didn't just wake up one morning and decide, this is what I'm going to do. I think at some point or other, there was a, you know, like an aha moment, a eureka moment, where you found yourself somewhere and you realize that I enjoy being here, and this is the place that I think perhaps I'm going to stick around. And as a person who's more a consumer than anything else, I am utterly grateful to people like you, because it's people like you who are willing to take the risks that I think make it that much easier for the rest of us to be able to come on board. But before we get into the rest of the conversation, can you give us a brief overview on what Warbler Labs is?
Yes, I can get us started there. So Warbler Labs is a company, a technology service provider that is focused currently on developing the Goldfinch protocol. So the Goldfinch protocol has a DAO structure, and as a protocol, it is a decentralized, basically a decentralized platform. It is a credit protocol. So what it does is it facilitates credit products and connects investors and borrowers. And the Warbler Labs team specifically is made of engineers, marketers, financial service professionals, business people, etc. And the idea is the Goldfinch DAO has allocated, so the community very much of the Goldfinch protocol has allocated some budget whereby specific members of the community. So Warbler Labs is one part of the community, but there are other community members that also get paid to do things that are in favor of the community interest. And so there is a budget that has been allocated for Warbler Labs to perform certain functions that are vital for the development of the Goldfinch platform.
And I would say that today the Warbler Labs exists entirely in support of the Goldfinch protocol, but there's, you know, there is the opportunity. I think we can think about Warbler Labs as being a team of people that are sort of really interested in seeing crypto almost like reshape the global economy and expand access to capital across the world. And so we're entirely focused on Goldfinch protocol right now, but, you know, it's possible that there are other use cases that we think are interesting that the Warbler Labs team also supports in addition to Goldfinch.
I'm curious to know what it's like to work on something so global, but also hand in hand with a DAO, because my experience with DAOs is always, you know, it's give or take. You either you get it really, really right, or you get it really, really wrong. Thankfully, I've been blessed enough to be in a DAO that I feel is getting a lot of things right. But I'm curious to know what it's like to deal with so many, you know, voices and so many people when you're trying to operate or run something that is this impactful and deals with so much money and so many, you know, other external individuals that you have to keep satisfied and happy. How is that, you know, for the both of you, but also how does one even navigate something like that?
Yeah, that's a difficult question. I think, I think that it's very interesting. It almost feels like running your own sort of mini country or operating your own mini country. But with people that are in different parts of the world, with varying interest levels, varying sort of use cases that they believe make sense for the protocol. But it's really exciting. I think it's to sort of be working on a problem or in a problem space that is for which you have people in different parts of the world, tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of people interested in a solution and really bought in and passionate enough to be involved on an ongoing basis, I think is exciting. And it definitely comes with its challenges because it does feel like you are, like I was saying, responsible for a lot of people and almost responsible for organizing a lot of people. Maybe that's what I should say. But yeah, it's exciting to me.
And maybe what I'd add to what Ubina was saying, because I definitely agree that it is a challenge. It's also a big opportunity. So we're lucky enough that we have a wonderful head of community, Hai Pohan, that kind of like helps us structure the way we think about the community in general. We're lucky to have very active community members, and a lot of our community members, I would say, reflect what the protocol does. So in our community, we've kind of like structured some grant programs whereby individual members of the community globally can participate and be paid for doing things that are valuable to the protocol and the protocol community as a whole. So people get paid to write credit memos that are read by other parts of the community. And so the people who write these credit memos have 20, 30 years of experience in finance and in credit. So those are community members that can sit anywhere in the world. And if there is, let's say, an investment opportunity that is in India, we're able to find in the Goldfinch community credit professionals in India that can kind of like look at data and inform or like help analyze the information that is available to investors in the community of Goldfinch and help them kind of like read it, you know, decipher it, etc. So I think we have this very, I would say, fortunate opportunity to leverage our community to do things that are extremely valuable for the protocol. Another, I think, element that helps us as well from a community management and at the global scale, because as you pointed, Ms. Purple, it is a complex endeavor, is what we call tokenomics. And tokenomics are really an incentive system that is always a work in progress, is never completely static, is something that you change over time depending on your needs, depending on your challenges, etc. But that kind of like try to orchestrate and incentivize the right behaviors around the community. So trying to make sure that, you know, different basically members of the community with different kind of like functions, different priorities, different, you know, interests, are incentivized to do the right thing for the community as a whole. And I think that's like, we have written quite a lot on it, on our Discord, on our Medium, and anyone who's interested can go kind of like read. But that's like another part that's more kind of like economics, you know, economic incentives, if you will, that are put in place to kind of like try to orchestrate behaviors and from a behavioral science perspective, making sure that at a macro level, we are, you know, trying to push for the right behaviors. Of course, it's not perfect, and language is a barrier. We need to try to be transparent, but it's not always like information is not flowing always perfectly. We also have to have a very strong governance so people have trust in the way the DAO is kind of like managed and organized, etc. So there are very big challenges, but I would say those are some of the tools that we use to try and make it better.
Before you answer this next question, I'd like to let the listener know that there is a short and sweet explainer video on the Goldfinch Foundation YouTube page from about 2 months ago. So it's under 2 minutes long and it only gives a brief explanation of how Goldfinch works. So to add a more personal touch to that explanation, I'm going to ask the both of you, how did Goldfinch come about? How does it work? And who is it geared towards?
Yeah, so I think the sort of origin of Goldfinch came from a place where, so our founders, Mike and Blake, who are both ex-Coinbase, were working at Coinbase at the time, and I think became interested in DeFi, and specifically DeFi sort of promise to basically reshape the global economy. But we're sort of seeing a situation where a lot of the activity in DeFi was very self-referential, right? So, you know, there was no, if you think about sort of DeFi as it existed then, maybe to a higher degree as it existed then, but even as it exists today, there is a lot of the activity that happens, it's almost for the purpose of DeFi, right? And so it's sort of self-referential in that sense, right? So one example is even how you generate yield, right? So for folks who are looking for folks who are in DeFi looking to generate yield, a lot of the way that you generate yield today is very much linked to or correlated with the crypto markets, right? So it's really impossible for you right now to earn yield that is generated from real economic activity if you're in DeFi today, right? And so I think that's sort of the problem that the sort of the early team saw, is that on one hand, you have the promise that DeFi has to really reshape the way the global economy works, particularly the global capital markets. But on the other hand, a lot of what was happening at the time was very much almost DeFi for the sake of DeFi, and almost you can call them even money games, right? And so Goldfinch was really sort of, it came about from a place of like trying to sort of really achieve the true promise that DeFi has. And the way that we went about it was to start by trying to address this like global credit problem, like the siloed nature of the global credit markets, like I was describing in the earlier part of this interview. And really what sort of Goldfinch is, and what Goldfinch is right now is, Goldfinch is basically a protocol that allows folks who have capital to earn yield from real world economic activity, wherever that's happening in the world, right? Primarily folks who have DeFi native capital in the form of stable coins to earn yield wherever that's happening in the world. So if you're in DeFi right now, you don't necessarily need to sort of earn yield through DeFi native protocols. You can earn yield through more sustainable yield from real economic activity from different parts of the world that, you know, before now have been pretty siloed from the market. So that's sort of like a high level view on how we started and what we're building right now. Ja, I'm not sure if you have anything to add to that.
Not much. I think you said it all, but maybe one point about who is it geared towards on the other side. It's also geared towards, you know, businesses outside of the traditional finance system or that have had trouble raising funds in the traditional finance system to be able to have access to a global pool of investors. And so the businesses that have raised money on the Goldfinch platform have been able to essentially raise money from both institutional investors and retail investors globally. And that is something that in the traditional finance system and with the infrastructure that exists is not really possible, and especially at that scale. And so part of what the Goldfinch protocol does is kind of like filling a gap currently in the credit market, whereby in the global south mainly, businesses trying to raise between, I'd say, 10 million to 50, 60 million have a very hard time raising that in the form of debt. Below 10 million, you would find potentially a local bank that's able to, or maybe some kind of like high net worth local individual who's able to kind of like, you know, lend you that money if you have the solid fundamentals. If you are, you know, if you're trying to raise 100 million plus, the large global banks are willing, even if they don't have maybe a headquarters or like an office in your locality, to kind of like come do the due diligence and like have a privileged relationship with any business that's reached that size. But in the middle, where a lot of the growth happens, there isn't much. And so I think the Goldfinch protocol is also uniquely placed to kind of like help businesses that are scaling and that need debt for that to kind of like access capital that has a global nature and from both retail and institutional investors. Yeah.
So the only other thing I'll add to that is that today the Goldman protocol is almost like single direction, the way that Gerard just described, where we have capital providers that typically sit outside of the Global South providing capital to opportunities in the Global South. But, you know, there's also a world where folks who are in the Global South who are looking for yield from sources that they can't access in the Global South can use the Goldfinch protocol to do that, right? So if I'm sitting in, you know, Kenya and I want access to yields that are generated from US real estate, right, there's a world in which the Goldfinch protocol can get me that in a way that didn't exist before. So it's really just sort of creating this global marketplace where anyone in the world can earn yield from anything in the world or any opportunity in the world in a way that doesn't exist right now.
I love that as a tagline, connecting the world's capital. It sounds like a such a far-fetched dream, but you know, when one looks closely at what Goldfinch is doing, you start to realize that it's closer than a lot of us perhaps have been paying attention to. So I'm curious to know, what role does Goldfinch and, you know, other players like you play in this space, particularly with the current market conditions? You know, I'm sure everybody has heard the macro and the very powerful three-letter organizations every single where you turn, whether it's, you know, newsletters or news articles or even on podcasts. So what role do any of you feel Goldfinch plays in a space with market conditions such as these?
I can start there. I mean, the Goldfinch protocol is part of what we call the RWA space in DeFi, RWA for real world assets. And so the idea is to try and break the insular nature of a lot of things that were done in crypto before. So I think you were mentioning the current environment. There's been a number of scandals, and I'm not going to name them, where crypto, I would say, has hurt consumers, and certain, you know, crypto projects have kind of like created major losses, and these losses have spread. And the idea from the inception of the Goldfinch protocol was to actually create something using the blockchain. And so we say crypto, but it's really using the blockchain as a rail and connecting it with the real world. And so by nature, it's insulating itself from the overall crypto ecosystem, the way it was built initially. And the self-referential side of it, whereby one protocol borrows from another protocol that borrows from another protocol, and where the contagion has been kind of like spreading with all of these different kind of tragedies that we've seen in the past few months. So I'd say the current environment has proven, if anything, the fact that Goldfinch has kind of like created a condition or a structure that can insulate itself from some of the crypto risk. Now, it doesn't mean that we're not impacted at all by you know, the current market conditions, because besides what's going on in crypto, we also see a very difficult rate environment, right? Like the Fed in the US has increased the rates. There's been rate hikes for the past few months, and we may continue to see rates going higher, or at least stabilizing at a very high level. What that means, it's very hard for businesses to raise capital. And so, you know, the demand for capital has never been stronger, and the supply is drying up. A lot of investors have the ability to now invest in safe, I'd say, you know, instruments, safe financial instrument in the traditional system that earn pretty good yield. And so those are preferred options. So I'd say the extent to which the current environment has impacted us is that it's, you know, there's been capital has been drying to a certain extent. It's harder to attract capital onto our platform. It's not specifically to our platform. I think that's a market condition, but that is still something that we've been affected by. I think it's been slower on that front, but where I think we've proven our model is that the kind of like contagion that we've seen in the crypto world has not affected us directly. We've been lucky enough, touch wood, to continue the course, being able to continue developing products and innovating. And I would say even that we're taking this market condition of a slower activity on the capital raise front to kind of like heads down, go and build new products. So with the current rate environment, we see that there are an array of other credit products that are interesting and that could attract some of the Goldfinch investors. And so we're trying to kind of like expand our product offering to opportunities that are, you know, as Obina was mentioning before, why not, you know, offering opportunities that are, you know, real estate in the US or like treasury bills or any other kind of like credit product. The idea for us is to connect the real world kind of like the real world with, you know, a new infrastructure for finance and an infrastructure that's kind of more efficient, where there is less fee capture, where things go faster, where there is a very high degree of trust. And so we're kind of like staying the course, continuing to build that. And there may even be an opportunity for us to accelerate on that front. So we're going for it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think the only thing that I'd probably add to this is, and she touched on this earlier, is that I think that, like, if you think about, I think crypto up until, you know, RWA protocols came about, was very much, like I was saying before, self-referential and almost existed for the benefit of folks in crypto. And there isn't any other sort of like step change technological shifts that have existed like that. For any important technology shift or introduction, right, they have interacted with the real world in a way that provides real value to participants in the real economy, right? Whether that's saving on fees, making things faster, you know, every single sort of technological improvement has had a way of making lives of people in the real world better. We don't think crypto is going to be any different. And I think what we are doing, along with other real world asset protocols, is figuring out ways to make this sort of promise of crypto and DeFi real for people in the real world, right? So for folks who are in Nigeria or in Kenya or in Southeast Asia, right? Giving loans to Buddha drivers, for example, right? Like, how do you make this promise of crypto real for that person? And I think that sort of, that's really what I, the value that I think real world asset protocols are providing. And yeah, I'm really excited by it.
What do you think it would take for, you know, the typical retail investor, but also like how you say in the board of what a driver, what would it take for them to make that direct and very impactful connection between DeFi and real world assets without, you know, trying so hard to separate the two and act as if one just kind of begets the other, but they're not supposed to go together? What stands in the way between where we are now and where we could be when it comes to making that connection?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question and very interesting. So I think my personal belief is that for sort of the like very end beneficiaries of protocols like ours, it's going to be a while before they're able to sort of tie or attribute the changes that they're seeing to DeFi, right? Because I think it's going to be a while before you get those sort of Buddha drivers or market sellers or whatever on chain. But I think what you will see is that between a protocol like Goldfinch and a Buddha driver, there's a bunch of intermediaries. Right. And I think what the promise of Goldfinch and other similar protocols is like holds is to really just make capital flow, right, through these intermediaries to that end consumer in a much more efficient way than it has through the traditional financial system. Right. And so for me, thinking about sort of the impact that real world asset protocols have, I think that will, you know, that impact will first be felt through these intermediaries that sort of help take capital from one place to the other place, from protocols like ours on to these Buddha drivers, or and so I don't know that there's a world in the near future where like an end consumer is attributing everything the positive changes that they're seeing to DeFi. I do think that that world is coming, right? I think for that to happen, there will need to be sort of really widespread adoption of crypto across a lot of these specifically emerging markets that that capital is being deployed into. You would need to have sort of cash flows on chain. You know, folks will need to be comfortable getting paid, on chain. Folks will need to be comfortable sort of transacting in their local economies through crypto. And I definitely think that world is possible, but I don't think that, I think we're a bit of a ways from there. And I actually don't think that for gold, for DeFi or crypto to be like truly impactful, we have to wait for that time. Right. I think there's a lot of value that can be created between them.
I entirely agree with what Obinna was saying. I also believe that for the end consumer to really feel at scale that DeFi is changing, basically, or that the blockchain infrastructure is changing their life, I think there is a lot of work, and part of it is having cash flow on chain, as Obinna was saying, and that will take time. But I think even if they may not see it directly, they're already currently impacted, right? Like the work that a Goldfinch protocol does, even if it's to kind of like, we lend money to credit funds often, sometimes to fintechs, but these fintechs go and in turn lend money to a Boda Boda driver who's able to buy a motorcycle. That's happening today with Tugende. We're lending to Tugende, and Tugende is lending to, you know, a Boda Boda driver that's able to have a job, feed their family, because they're able to buy basically a productive asset by acquiring a motorcycle. So I feel like the impact is there, whether or not the Boda Boda driver knows that this was possible because there is a new form of finance that's enabled, you know, the fintech that's lending them to kind of like raise at a lower interest rate with less fees, with more ease, faster, etc. In a way, maybe, does it matter or not? I mean, it would be great if they knew it, but I think just the fact that that's possible and that's enabling something to me is extremely, extremely important. And I think one thing that I like to keep in mind is how young this industry is, right? How young this industry is. And I think a lot of the things, when you take crypto as a whole, that have happened are potentially growing pains. I mean, some of the things that have happened in the past few months are absolutely unacceptable and are just like pure theft and you know, just like unethical behavior. Other things I think are growing pains of a very young industry. And these unfortunate events, I think, are going to teach and enable consumers, regulators, business people to kind of like create norms that are conducive to better business, such that consumers can be more trustful, and such that after, you know, in the next decade or so, we can see actually cash flows on chain and people feeling comfortable having a wallet and feeling comfortable transacting directly peer-to-peer among each other using crypto, etc. So for me, what would it take, you were asking, for kind of like the end consumer to see the actual impact of decentralized finance in their day-to-day? I think it will take a lot of education, like making sure that we're able to articulate very clearly the value to end users. And I think there is a lot of work there. I think it will take creating products and creating services that, you know, improve safety for the use of these products and improve trust that consumers have for these products. And I think it will also take, I'm very regulation forward. I think it will take also creating the right regulatory environment. So of course, I hope that, especially on the continent, we're able to create regulatory environments that are enabling more than just completely banning, because I think the continent is one of the places in the world where there is, you know, so much to gain from the development of this technology, because the traditional infrastructure, the traditional financial infrastructure, has never been able to really serve the needs of the continent. There's a $2.5 trillion credit gap. So we would, you know, benefit a lot as Africans to have the development of this technology, but we need to make sure it's done safely, so that consumers are ready to go on board. And so I think regulation will play a very big part. But for me, if you know, if the innovation is clear, if, you know, there is value, African consumers are very technology forward. We've seen it with, you know, the mobile money and other kind of like technology, you know, adoptions in the past, you know, decade. And so I'm sure that if we're able to like put together these different elements and have compelling use cases, I'm confident that, you know, people are going to actually adopt it.
I like that. I like, you know, especially how you also mentioned that we cannot run away from regulation. I think so many times when we're in this space and we hear, when we hear the words regulation, a lot of people tend to panic and they want to run away because, you know, you just automatically clump them in with all the bad guys. But we cannot deny the fact that regulation allows, you know, the good guys to keep on going and tries to curb the bad guys from continuing forward. I think if anything, we have learned any particular lesson from this last year is that you need the bad guys to be curbed because they will continue unperturbed with nobody trying to call them out whatsoever if there is no sense of, you know, any kind of regulation or anything else along the way. So it's quite interesting. And I know it's a very touchy subject for a lot of people, but I think it needs to be had in many ways and from multiple different angles as well. So Web3 and DeFi on their own and together are extremely important to this new era of finance and freedom that we're trying to get into, right? But what is the fundamental importance to African economies from a financial or a financing lens? Is there something here? Is there something in particular, maybe a switch of some sort that could change our economies on a continental scale?
I think a number of things. One, I think the for me, the sort of most important benefit of crypto for the continent is, like we were saying earlier, this idea that or this ability for it to really create a truly global like economy, right? Like, I think the fact that once I can swap from my Naira to my USDC, right, the same opportunities that are available for folks in the US are available to me in Lagos, I think is really a step change. Right. And you know, I think that then you can start to think about all the different sort of benefits like that I'm describing. We've spoken about yield. That's one of them, but there's even sort of just, you know, preservation of value, and preservation of your wealth. There's the ability for you to send money, very, very, seamlessly, across the world without sort of the exorbitant fees that exist right now. There's the ability for you to stream revenue, right? So instead of being paid every month, you get paid on a daily basis or whatever, which is made easier by the fact that you're in DeFi. There's really so much, if you think about sort of the use cases of finance, right? Spend, save, invest. there's really sort of a step change improvement across the board for that, that comes about by being in this place where you're all of a sudden, by moving from your local currency to this into crypto, right, all the same opportunities are available for you. And for me, I think that's really the big the big promise here.
Yeah, I mean, I entirely agree with Obina, and I think for me, when I think about, you know, Web3 crypto in the context of Africa, I always start with demographics, right? I think that when you really wrap your head around the idea that in 2050, which is really not that long, we'll have 2.5 billion people on the continent, and that will represent 25% of the global population. So it is massive. Africa is going to become the one of the biggest markets, and also because there's so much so many services and so many products have still not been accessible for so many people on the continent, there is a massive opportunity. There is, of course, a ton of risks, right? Like, we know that financial inclusion is extremely low. We know that there is a very, very large financing gap. Jobs are not available to a majority of Africans. The informal sector is growing, but also often unstructured. And so it can also be a curse. So what that means for me is that we absolutely need, the continent absolutely need to build infrastructure and to kind of like massively give access to finance to its growing population. And so, you know, the current traditional financial systems have failed to kind of like keep up, which is why we have this gigantic, financial gap. And so for me, blockchain and crypto represent a historic opportunity. We have a very large need and we have a technology that enables us to, instead of kind of like continuing to improve at the margin and basically kind of, you know, course correct from something that was fundamentally not built to kind of like, you know, basically serve the continent, serve its needs, serve its kind of like particularities. Instead of kind of like trying to adapt something that was never designed to serve the continent, we have the opportunity to build something from scratch. And I think that's a massive opportunity. I think that's a historic opportunity. I think it would be such a pity to kind of like miss that opportunity. I also think that because the blockchain in and of itself is kind of like permissionless, decentralized, there is also an opportunity for ownership and building solutions, like for Africans to build solutions by themselves, for themselves, while relying on a global system. So I think all of these things put together make me think that, you know, there is a need and almost, I would say, an imperative for Africans to kind of like get more and more comfortable with this technology, understand it, and basically take ownership to kind of like make it work for, you know, everyday problems. And I think the problems that someone in rural areas, let's say in Mali, will face, maybe that someone that's cattle herding versus someone that's like, you know, I don't know, in Joburg, in an urban environment, will be different. So when we say Africa, it doesn't mean it's like one single thing. I think there will be many, many different use cases, many, many different kinds of needs. But I find a lot of hope and a lot of comfort in the fact that it is a decentralized system. And so it will, by design, enable kind of like localized solution. And so that to me is also another factor that I think, you know, presents an opportunity. So all of that will take a lot of work. It's not something that's going to happen overnight. But I think and I hope, and I think it's part of what why Obinna and I, you know, joined the bandwagon. I think that's why, you know, a podcast like Benefits Africa is so popular, is this massive opportunity. And so I'm hoping that, you know, it will make a very big difference.
So how does all of this fare against the rising cost of capital? And also not forgetting to factor in exchange rates. You know, anybody who lives on the African continent knows how insane it is. Every single day you look at the exchange rate to the dollar and it's like it's just magic numbers because every day it's very surprising because you don't know is it going to be more expensive tomorrow or today. You can get paid the same amount, $500 today and next week, but it's a different amount to you in your local currency. So how do all these developments fare against both the rising cost of capital but also, you know, the inevitable exchange rates that we have to deal with every other day?
So yeah, I mean, we could talk about the exchange rate first. I think that, yeah, you're right, it's crazy. I feel like the numbers keep going in one direction, in the direction that it's not beneficial to us. But I think that, you know, if we think about it from the other lens, right, the fact that folks can one, earn sort of local currency and immediately with stable coins be able to preserve the value of that capital almost instantaneously from when they get paid, it is a step change improvement, right, from what we've had in the past. Typically, right, it's the case that you have to sort of get, you know, if you're in Nigeria, for example, right, you get Naira. You look for a way to sort of convert that to dollars in the black market, you know, look for a way to deposit that in cash into your bank. And even that cash isn't globally accessible, right? So the fact that you can immediately go from whatever local currency you have into a stable coin and have that be globally accessible and for you to be able to use that anywhere in the world, I think is a huge step change improvement from what exists in the market today. I also think that opening up the global economy in the way that crypto has even allows folks who are the way that the internet and crypto has even allows folks who typically would have only been only had sort of local currency earning opportunities, all of a sudden be able to work for in jobs and exposes them to opportunities where they can get paid in stablecoin. And then that sort of exchange rate craziness that you're describing begins to even work in their favor. So that's sort of from an exchange rate perspective. From an interest rate perspective, I think that's a little bit harder because this is sort of what we're seeing is really an unwinding of a money printing cycle that was happening for 2 years during COVID, right? And so I'm of the opinion that interest rates will stay high for some time. And I think because they will stay high for some time, it's possible that emerging market countries, primarily African countries, will struggle. But then even like, I think if you take away crypto from this equation, if folks in sort of African countries were left to their devices without crypto and were only sort of subject to whatever consequences of this rising interest rate environment creates, I think there's a much worse wealth effect that they feel versus being in this position where, you know, your local currency and your local economy are not your only option. You can participate in a global economy thanks to crypto. I think it just helps to sort of soften the effects that we're feeling, which I think we will be feeling for some time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm 100% aligned with what Obinna just described. I think you were mentioning, you know, FX, but also capital control. Unfortunately, I believe that some of these questions crypto will not be able to solve. And for capital control specifically, those are, you know, more governance and kind of like, you know, local, basically economic policy issues that, you know, crypto may not be able to solve. But I do think that crypto should help make these things better. And to the point that Obinna was making, the idea of being able to preserve your wealth and creating basically savings at a national level should make the life of, you know, economic policymakers easier. Because one of the, you know, largest problems that economies on the African continent have is the lack of, you know, hard currency, basically the availability of hard currency such as the US dollar. And so because of the need and the scarcity of these resources, there is a need to kind of like impose capital controls to not destabilize the economy. And so if tomorrow, you know, somebody who earns, you know, their wage in Ghana in cedis has the opportunity on their phone instantaneously to kind of like convert that, you know, these assets into gold or into US dollars. That kind of enables the country as a whole to kind of like create a certain amount of savings in hard currencies. And then over time, that also solidifies the local economy that can in turn kind of like develop more and more, you know, I would say innovative, maybe economic policies. So I think crypto in that sense can make things better, not overnight, but I think over time. And then for the rise of the cost of capital, I think to me what is key is that with the rise of the cost of capital for a global investor, what that means is they have opportunities to invest in opportunities that are not traditionally considered very risky and receive a very high yield. So what does that mean? If I'm an investor and my hurdle rate or kind of like my investment, you know, thesis and target is, I don't know, to get 7% annually APY, now I'm able to do that, you know, or let's say 4% by just literally investing in what is considered the zero risk credit option, which is the US Treasury bill. And so what that means is I may not go for the more risky opportunities. And traditionally, you know, investment opportunities in the global south have been considered riskier. And so I think that connecting global investors at a deeper level with opportunities in the global south, makes sure that if a traditional investor would go towards the safer option, maybe a business, let's say in Peru, has the opportunity to go look for the one investor that's still interested in taking risk. And of course, you're going to have to, you know, like price that risk and it will still be expensive, but maybe someone has this appetite. So the idea for me is crypto and kind of like protocols such as Goldfinch make it possible for in dire times like these, make it possible for kind of like businesses that need capital to go find the one investor that is actually suited to take the risk and be compensated, of course, fairly for it, that they kind of like have to offer, as opposed to kind of like having a very small set of investors that are maybe more kind of like, you know, that have more of a traditional investment thesis. And these this capital usually is going to dry up completely in times when the cost of capital, you know, rises, and kind of like it will, you know, expand when the cost of capital becomes lower. And so I think that these economies have been really hit by these kinds of cycles. And I feel like crypto can kind of soften the consequences of a capital market drying up. By basically allowing any business to kind of find the one investor that has the appetite and the right mandate to kind of like, you know, finance them.
Yeah, I really agree with this point that John was bringing up. And then I would also point out that, you know, it's also possible if you think about the other direction of the capital flow, where in a world without crypto, where, you know, economies are super siloed, if I was in Nigeria, it's really hard for me to even benefit from this, like, you know, treasury bill situation that John was describing, right? And so the fact that crypto allows me to take advantage of this, right, as, you know, small business in Kenya that has some extra capital, allows me to take advantage of this increasing interest rate environment by investing in treasury bills, or investing in US real estate, or investing in something for which the rising interest rate environment is, you know, creating, is making higher, is making yield higher, I think is really exciting. And yeah, without crypto, I don't know that would be entirely possible.
I think if anything, crypto is forcing a lot of people to see multiple opportunities. It's not, you know, the be all end all. It doesn't have all the answers that we need. But I think for a lot of us, it's offering a lot more insight into what is actually possible outside of just, you know, our localized possibilities in our own little silos. But to kind of put a little a nice bow on this conversation to wrap it up in a full circle kind of way, what new features or elements can you share about Goldfinch with Bankless Africa?
I can start us there. I think, you know, as we had started saying, Goldfinch's vision is really to connect the world's capital with the world's growth. And in the current environment, we have been kind of like made more confident that that model works, that that model is, you know, has a very high demand. And that it has the benefit of kind of like being able to insulate itself from some of the rest of the crypto environment. And so we're building faster than ever. And I think because our ambition is really to connect generally capital with growth, we're trying to expand the range of products that we're offering. So we started with emerging market credit, which is, I would say, a side of the spectrum that's on the riskier side. And now we're kind of like experimenting and developing new products and like making sure that the community and investors generally have access to kind of like, you know, credit products that are on a different side of the spectrum from a risk perspective. So we're considering, you know, from real estate, let's say in the US or could it be in Europe, to kind of like all the way to treasury bills. Like we're kind of like trying to expand basically the range of products that we're offering, because as we were saying before, there is an interest both from, you know, the kind of like everyday person, let's say on the African continent or in Latin America, that is suffering from, you know, basically a lack of ability to preserve their capital to kind of access these opportunities on the global, level. And so we're kind of like basically, I'd say, yeah, expanding that. I think another side of the work we're doing is upgrading our platform and making it really institution friendly. So in the first kind of like development of the Goldfinch protocol, we've had a mix of institutions and retail investors, and some of them being crypto native, other being less crypto native. And we're realizing that basically the products that we're offering should really appeal to institutions. We believe that institutions in the next wave are going to be the ones that are going to like bring growth and scale to this kind of like new use case. And so there is work on our part to kind of like upgrade some of the things that we're doing. So from a risk perspective, from a due diligence perspective, and then just generally governance, transparency, communication, et cetera, from a legal perspective as well. So like we're also doing that work of kind of like making sure that we have everything in place to kind of give full comfort to any institution of any size to participate in the protocol.
No. I think she summarized it perfectly. The only thing I'll add is that one of the things that we've been thinking a bit about is sort of liquidity needs for different investors. And so thinking through an array of products that we can provide, as I was described, that are on sort of the less riskier end of the spectrum, but also that are that offer higher liquidity for folks who want to participate, want to earn yield, but don't necessarily want their capital locked up for you know 2 years at a time. So yeah, we're innovating a lot in that space to give people more liquidity on their capital.
I'm here for the growth, the innovation, and all the developments that Goldfinch is doing. I know that the first time I heard of Goldfinch, I thought it was something that I did not need to know about, but fast forward to today, I am finding it quite interesting for me to continue learning and discovering what it is Goldfinch is doing and, you know, the possibilities behind what this represents, not just for your typical investor, but also for the people on the ground, you know, your retail investors. It means that we're getting that one step closer to being able to access certain opportunities that we're not always as easy to access for a lot of people. Now, how we like to end off our conversations is I like to ask our guests to give me three words on how you would describe your feeling about the space in general. So whether it's Web3 or DeFi in particular, anything about, you know, the entire frontier, how would you describe how it makes you feel in three words?
Definitely excited. I think we're on the cutting edge here. I'm really excited to see what the next couple of years hold. I think promise is another one. I think there's a lot of promise here, especially for folks on the continent. And then I'm going to introduce one sort of downer word, which is regulation. I think we need clarity. And sort of sound regulatory frameworks for this to really deliver on the promise.
Thanks, Ubina, for going first. That gave me a minute to think about it. I think for me, the first word that comes to mind is massive. I think this could be massive from an impact perspective and from the scale of, you know, the number of people it could reach, the size of industry it could build. I think it could be massive, and that's one thing that comes to mind. The second part is I'm hopeful. I think working on this every day, I feel extremely privileged, and I think that what I see, what I hear, gives me a lot of hope. And then the last word, which I think kind of is a similar sentiment to what Ubina was sharing around regulation, was maybe caution. I think this is, you know, crypto is touching something that's extremely precious that we need to be very careful about. As much as we're all, you know, innovation forward, excited about all of it, I think we need to be extremely responsible because we're touching often people's savings, we're touching people's net worth, and we have to make sure that we bring forward safe use cases. And so, yeah, caution would be my last word.
I don't think I've heard caution or regulation on any of the three words I've asked our guests, but I think they are very welcome. Sometimes you do need a reminder that you need to remember that even finance as we know it in the, you know, everyday world is never been 100% safe. It's never been 100% secure. You're always reminded and advised that you should only risk what you're comfortable losing because nothing is certain and nothing is guaranteed. So thank you for those reminders, but also thank you for sharing your hope with us. You know, I think this entire conversation is a reminder that there are people like you who are building from a very elevated position. And it's not just, I'm going to create an NFT and raise all this money and give you all utility or whatever the heck else. So thank you again for all the work you do at Warbler Labs and with Goldfinch. I am beyond grateful to be able to continue speaking to you. And I hope, I wish you nothing but the best in your next journey. And you know, the next few quarters, next few years, however many it takes, I only wish to see only great things from Goldfinch and from both you, Abina, and Jiao.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Miss Purple. This, you know, was something we talked about a month ago, and I'm so glad we finally did it. Feel super privileged. Thank you so much for having us on your, you know, on your podcast. I'm also really excited because Abina and I mean, I'm so privileged to work with him, and we have conversations about Africa and the use cases for crypto on the continent all the time. So it was really fun to have one of these conversations with you and to be doing this together. It's really fun. Thank you.
Thank you for spending another episode with me. Just a reminder that none of what we share is financial advice, only opinions of the individuals that make this show possible. You can use the links in the show notes to do your own research. Don't forget to subscribe, share, and give us a rating on whatever platform you're listening from. We are our own wildest dreams, the hope of our own tomorrow. So until next time, keep innovating.